In this episode, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit hears United States v. Enclade, case number 24-30684. The defendants, Travis Enclade and his co-defendant Wilson, were convicted of conspiracy to distribute narcotics and related charges after law enforcement raided a stash house in New Orleans and found large quantities of drugs, firearms, and drug processing equipment. The central legal question on appeal is whether the evidence was sufficient to prove the conspiracy, whether a law enforcement agent improperly gave opinion testimony about drug code words and surveillance footage without being qualified as an expert, and whether certain jury instructions and closing arguments infected the verdict. The government's case turned heavily on poll camera surveillance, items recovered from the house, a recorded jailhouse phone call, and the testimony of the lead case agent who interpreted ambiguous conduct and language as drug dealing. The jury acquitted Enclade of direct possession, but convicted him of conspiracy, while Wilson was convicted on both counts. The appeal challenges the foundation and fairness of those verdicts.
Morning is 24-30684, United States versus Enclade.
Mr. Lehman now begins the argument for Travis Enclade.
Lehman, thank you. I'm sorry.
Morning, Your Honors. Thank you for entertaining argument on this matter. We have raised a number. I represent Mr. Travis Enclade, and along with co-counsel, we have some common issues and have decided to divvy them up as follows. I'd like to focus on the challenge to the sufficiency of the evidence, in particular as to the conviction on the conspiracy. My co-counsel will address in more depth the problems we have with the government's principal witness, Agent Brentz.
De novo review is the standard of appellate review for sufficiency of the evidence claims. It means the Court of Appeals examines the record in the light most favorable to the verdict and asks whether any rational jury could have found guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. The appellate court does not defer to the trial court's judgment on this question, but reviews the legal sufficiency independently, hence de novo or anew. It is a searching standard, the one that still respects the jury's role as fact finder.
Dealing with the de novo review of the sufficiency of the evidence, as the court's well aware, we have contested proof of the requisite elements of the conspiracy, in particular the agreement between the two defendants to violate narcotics laws. The government's response has been to point to four elements of proof which they contend substantiate the conviction, which was the poll cam footage surveillance, the evidence seized from the stash house, jailhouse call, and the witness testimony. And I'd like to comment on each of these elements of evidence for a minute. This is a constructive possession case, right?
Constructive possession allows the government to prove a defendant possessed contraband even when it was not on his person. The government must show the defendant had both the power to control the item and the intent to exercise that control, often inferred from access to the location, personal effects nearby, and the visibility of the contraband. Courts have held that merely being present where drugs are found, or being related to someone who lives there, is not enough. There must be evidence linking the defendant to knowing dominion over the drugs.
This is the real issue at trial was whether or not, there's no dispute, people going in and out of the various houses.
Correct.
The drugs are found in the houses.
Correct.
So the question is, who could the jury decide had constructive possession?
Possession in essence, but I mean,
one of your arguments to us is that you can't infer possession by virtue of a family relationship.
Correct.
So my question to you is, did the government ever argue in closing guilt based on family relationship?
No, they did not. They contended that the evidence, it's, you know, possession as reflects an agreement to violate the narcotics laws, I think is relevant. But their argument was that there was enough proof of orchestration between the two defendants to substantiate the conspiracy finding, which we disagree with. Because if you look at the evidence, all it really amounted to I mean, there was, you know, obviously drugs were seized from the stash house. That is pertinent. That is proof. But the problem, the case falls apart when you try to link my client in particular to that X.
Right. But we do have a poll camera and he's there going in and out.
He is there going in and out, but I would suggest.
Wilson said, well, I was going in and out, I think, because of my father who was in there.
But correct.
What was your client's explanation for why he's going in and out?
He didn't testify. There was no explanation.
The government's theory.
The government's theory was that he was in cahoots and was orchestrating hand-to-hand drug transactions.
And was he the one that was seen with the backpack?
He was seen with the backpack.
Okay.
Yes,
that's where at least two of the types of drugs are found, in the backpack.
If you assume, which we can test, that it's the same backpack. But yes, that's the government's theory.
And that goes to Agent Bress's ability to tie up
friends.
The resistance.
Correct. Yes, that's true. And so what I would point out to you is that while he is seen going in and out of the house, it amounts to three times over the course of 3 weeks that my client was seen going in and out of the house. And the evidence recovered from the house really demonstrates, you know, there's some personal effects of Mr. Wilson. There's Mr. Wilson's father there. But my guy is really not that connected to this house in the same way, not even close. And there was an attempt made to suggest that he was observed during some hand-to-hand transactions, my client, but as we point out in our brief, the video does not substantiate that, and it's not even really connected to the Encampment Street address. All that it amounts to is Mr. Enclade being observed with a phone and a vape and a bag, which contents can't be discerned from the vantage point, which would be what I suggest. So what I think their case really boils down to on that point is that he did have a key. Mr. Enclade had a key and was, you know, did go into the house with the key.
And so then we're in the world. He clearly had access. No one disputing access. So under constructive possession, you have to show knowledge as well.
Knowledge.
Something in plain view, that's assumed. We've said that's enough. If the right? If a contraband charged item is in plain view, in a house where the person has a key to go into, that's enough for a jury verdict.
Well, I don't know that I would agree with that. I mean,
do you have a case that says that's not the law?
Not off the top of my head, no. But I think there needs to be a further demonstration. I think there's time constraints with regard to that, and I think, you know, there needs to be more of a showing of his access at the point in time where it's observed in plain view. And I don't think that was established.
Was your client on the jailhouse call?
He was on the jailhouse call.
So that's another piece of incriminating, but I guess it comes to Agent Bress's interpretive abilities.
Correct.
And which is going to be argued by co-counsel.
Correct.
But it was a jury question. Do you think that pertains to the sufficiency or not? And it's listed as a reversible error in the briefs. Will one of you be discussing that?
The jury question?
The jury question was,
correct.
Can we infer guilt because they're cohabiting with a convicted felon?
That's my issue.
That's your issue.
Yes. And
that's an odd question. You would think the answer from the judge would be no.
Exactly.
But nonetheless, the answer that was given was just reread the pattern instruction, and the two counsel at trial said, sounds okay, I'm with it.
I agree with you, and I would, you know, I think in the heat of the moment, that's the position they took. I would point out, in terms of if we're talking about a waiver, I don't think it was a waiver, because I think counsel for Enclade at the time offered something a little more proactive that the judge rejected, and then there was discussion, and then the judge came up with this proposal and had said any objections after he had already dismissed what the proffered explanation was, and it didn't happen. And I think that is pivotal. I mean, that, you know, relates to the felon in possession count, and I think what happened was it really just the jury had already been given the question, I mean, the instruction, and they misinterpreted it, and just re-upping and giving the same instruction didn't solve the problem. And the government even concedes in their brief that the answer to the question is no. Their contention is, you know, that the judge handled the problem by reasserting the instruction, which should have answered the question. But that doesn't really solve the problem, because they already had the instruction and they misread it. And so the only thing by it really only validated in their mind the conclusion that it could be merely enough to reside in a house. See, I'm running out of time. I don't want to trample on my co-counsel's time, but I'll reserve the rest for rebuttal.
Good May it please the court.
Celia Rhodes now begins the argument for Wilson.
Good morning. My name is Celia Rhodes with the Federal Public Defender's Office, and I represent Mr. Wilson. With my limited time, I'd like to first focus on what I see as the most impactful evidentiary error in this case, and that's Officer Bren's improper lay opinion testimony. Before I do that, Judge Higginson, I just want to clarify really quickly the issue of excessive constructive possession. Mr. Onclade, in particular, was acquitted of count two, the possession count of the drugs in the house. So really, the conspiracy count, so the jury rejected the theory that he was in constructive possession of the drugs in the house. And so that makes all the more important the flurry of activity outside of the house. The sort of Agent Bren's testimony about that they're engaged together in hand-to-hand transactions, that they're talking about drugs on the phone. So
was there a 922G on?
There was also a 922G in a different house. So,
okay, so it's not the backpack. The jury did not accept backpack tied to Enclave.
They at least didn't accept that he constructively possessed, but it was my understanding is that they didn't, and that's count. I believe that's count two.
So I agree. This is a case of constructive possession, and the lead agent, as often happens, testifies, and your client's in big trouble if you accept his testimony, because he tags your client with a gun, based on, and he tags your client with the drugs.
And he says he's a drug dealer, repeatedly based on his observations of surveillance. And that's why I want to focus on Rule 701.
Federal Rule of Evidence 701 permits lay witnesses, including police officers not qualified as experts, to give opinion testimony if it is rationally based on their own first-hand perception, helpful to the jury, and not based on specialized knowledge. The rule is meant to let a witness describe what they personally saw or heard in a shorthand way. But courts have repeatedly cautioned that an investigating agent may not simply invoke my investigation as a whole to opine on ultimate issues like guilt, drug jargon, or the meaning of ambiguous conduct, because that usurps the jury's role and smuggles in expert-like conclusions without the safeguards of expert qualification and disclosure.
So very briefly, just to reorient, under 701, lay opinion has to be rationally based on the witness's firsthand perception. It must be helpful to the jury's understanding of an event or a determination of fact. And it can't be based on specialized knowledge, which obviously falls under Rule 702. So as this court put it in Haynes,
the Fifth Circuit's opinion in United States versus Haynes lays out a framework, sometimes called the Haynes boxes, to distinguish permissible from impermissible lay opinion by law enforcement. Box 1 is expert testimony, which requires formal qualification. Box 2 is permissible lay opinion. An agent describes first-hand observations in lay terms, such as translating coded language the agent personally heard across many wiretaps in that investigation. Box 3 is impermissible. The agent offers a bottom-line opinion of guilt or drug dealing based on the investigation as a whole, without tying it to specific first-hand perceptions the jury lacks. The line between boxes 2 and 3 is often contested and fact-intensive.
I think that that is the most important case on this issue. It must describe something that the jurors could not otherwise experience for themselves, which is the helpfulness requirement. And it also must do so by drawing upon the person's observations that were made as a first-hand witness to a particular.
No one's saying it was box 1, that he was an expert.
No,
this is just whether it's permissible box 2 or impermissible box 3.
Exactly. So the government agrees he was not qualified as an expert.
But then the big problem a little bit here is even if you're right, this is all subject to plain error because there was no objection. Is that correct?
You're right. With the exception of the identification of the firearms being the same, this is subject to plain
error. And the objection to that was just speculation.
Right, which I do think is a set, in fairness, I do think is a 701
objection.
Right, 701. I think that that fits squarely within that. But you're right that the bulk of this is plain error. I actually disagree that it's a problem because I think that this is clear and obvious.
The reason a problem may just be us. If this is really tricky law, Haynes, the difference between box 3 and box 2, right?
Right.
Because an agent can say, based on my personal observations, I'll tell you, I guess the gun is very different than the drugs, right? I'm going to tell you that word ray that you heard means drugs.
Right. And I actually don't think this is tricky. I think Haynes does an excellent job of teasing this out. So we know from Haynes that it is permissible for an expert to testify about meanings within the drug world generally, right? The meanings of words that are commonly used, that are consistent throughout,
that's
right?
Not
and they can also testify that drug dealers use drug lingo, which is something that he said that he shouldn't have said. But agents can also...
They can also say, in this case, I've heard the wiretaps. That was the case we just heard. I've heard them all. And based on my personal knowledge of how these people talk, that's box two still.
Exactly, but that's not what happened in this case.
Okay, so and then that turns on, and I'm just interrupting because your time is precious.
Sure.
You probably want us to get down to anything.
Absolutely.
The difficulty is El Mazen.
Okay.
You remember that
yes.
case in footnote 13, where it does seem to be that our court said it doesn't have to be personal knowledge acquired from prior wiretaps. It can be personal knowledge from other facts in the investigation. And that... And therefore, here, I think the government's theory is, well, he heard ICE just once, ready. And he knows it means drugs because he ends up being the guy searching, and lo and behold, it's drugs.
So there's, I think that we're talking about two different things, right?
Okay.
So you can testify to a word having a meaning because you know that word has a meaning based on the rest of your investigation. And again, as long as you specify what that is, I want to be clear that he isn't saying based on something specific in an investigation, and for the most part, he's just citing his investigation as a whole, which we know under Haynes is patently impermissible. That's not considered firsthand knowledge under Haynes, and that's incorporating
frame. That's a little bit in tension with how I read El Mazen and the case El Mazen relies on Jackson. Mm-hmm. I thought there the court is saying an interpretation of an ordinary word is permissible as opinion. If it's sort of corroborated by something else that agent did.
Right, specific things within the investigation. And I'm just trying to separate the idea of the meaning of the term Ray, right, which he doesn't know. He says he's never heard it before, either in this investigation or others, which is different. I'm not saying it has to be wiretaps that are the basis for your knowledge of the meaning.
Well, what about then he goes into the house and there's the bag that he heard on the wiretap.
Yes.
And there's the drugs, and it's not Ray. There's no human in it. It's,
right. So I'll say two things.
Okay.
So one distinction between El Mazen and then also Atkins, Miranda, and Haynes is that information is fully available to the jury. They have a picture of the drugs under the sink in the cabinet, right? And so, and Haynes is very clear that you can't usurp the jury's function by making an inference that they just as equally could make. So he's not providing, that fails the helpfulness requirement. He's not providing them with any new information. But also, his opinion is the meaning of the word Ray. Right? He's saying that Ray is a code word for drugs, and he doesn't have any knowledge through his investigation.
I agree. It's hard to see how a Ray, which I assume is a human being or a sea creature, turns into drugs if there's no other use ever. Even if you're right, though, when I read the closing argument, the defense just mocks the government. This is, they say, ladies and gentlemen, all you've got to go on to get Mr. Wilson is this supernatural Agent Brett's, but look at the photos. How do you possibly know it's the same gun? Right? And so the comparison, even if it was a wrong one for Brett to do, wasn't the defense able to say, this is a joke?
Are you talking about the comparison between the guns?
Well, both, because both, your theory on both is that he's usurping the jury's role. It wasn't helpful. They can look at a photo just as well as he can. They can interpret the word Ray just as well as he can. So if it's a usurpation problem, why wasn't the defense just totally capitalizing?
Of course, and the defense can always try to capitalize on that. And I see my time's up, but I'll just very quickly to finish the question. If that were the case, right, if it were the case that it's never, that if the jury could have made the determination, then what's the harm, right? We would never reverse in the circumstance. The point of this, and this court has said this again and again, is you have a law enforcement agent put on the stand. He's telling you, my investigation as a whole, right? The entirety of my investigation is making me certain that these are drug transactions, that this call is about drugs, right? That is extremely harmful. And the government capitalizes on that in their closing. That is their entire case. This witness is their entire case. I see my time's up.
In government closing, they said, you heard Agent Brett say, The gun is Wilson's because it's in the photo. You heard Agent Bress say the drugs that were found are his because of the jailhouse call.
They highlight extensively the meaning of Ray. The gun, I think, is less important. I just want to be clear about the evidence that I think is important. What I think is the most important evidence is the interpretation of the phone call, and then also something we unfortunately didn't talk about, which is his interpretation of the surveillance, where he is saying, based on my investigation, specifically saying that, which is not allowed to say under Haynes, these are drug transactions. And that is also improper.
Well, you're also saying he didn't just say my, he said our.
Our investigation. He says, you know, I learned that somebody was, yes. Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court.
Patrick Barf now begins the argument for the United States.
Good morning, Your Honors. Patrick Barf for the United States. I agree that this case largely centers on the two issues that the appellants have brought up today, the sufficiency and Agent Brenz's testimony. I think that those are the biggest two issues, so I would focus my time on those unless...
But in a way, the closing argument allegation ties in, because according... So I hope you can address that too. Because in rebuttal closing argument, as I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, the prosecutor gets up and says, the agent said law enforcement knew who did it. But doesn't that tie in directly to a case where the government puts the lead agent on to say, ladies and gentlemen, we know why they're guilty, because I'll tell you, this gun is the gun. This gun that you see in the photo with Wilson is the gun they found. So he clearly had access and knowledge. It's his gun. And isn't this what the theory is? And then also Bress then turns out and says, and ladies and gentlemen, and the photo is 6 weeks before they find the gun, right?
Your Honor, are you talking about the photo with him while he's engaging in the hand-to-hand? He has a.
There's a photo that Bress says, that's the gun we found in the back. Correct me if I'm wrong. Isn't that right? Didn't Bress say, ladies and gentlemen?
So the photo of him, and I'm maybe confused because it is obviously a very large record. The photo of with the pistol, the handgun, is at a different location, and that was not part of the possession.
Wasn't tied to Wilson.
No. The possession was of the guns, the long gun found in the stash house, in the encampment house.
There's no gun in the bag.
There is a gun in the bag as well. That's a pistol, but I think, and I might...
It's sort of important.
Right.
I thought the jury was told by the lead agent, I've looked at this photo, I thought it was Wilson, maybe it's in Clade, and look at that gun he's got in his hand. And 6 weeks later, we're charging him with possession of a gun in a house, and it's one and the same. And if that were true, my question would be, how isn't that usurping the jury's role if Bress didn't articulate any specific characteristics? He just does a bare comparison. But maybe I'm wrong about my assumptions.
Your Honor, and again, I don't want to misspeak, but there was the previous litigation about the picture of him with the pistol, and I believe Agent Brenz identifies that as a pistol. But that was, the government conceded that it was not at that location. There might have been a connection between another photo, but I don't believe so.
Well, then let's focus on the Ray comment, because okay. That is the principal focus. Am I right there that Bress gets on the stand and he tells the jury that the word Ray used in the jailhouse call refers to the drugs that he then finds under the kitchen in the back? Is that a correct statement of what the government's theory was?
So... Yes, Your Honor.
Did Ray come up in any earlier wiretap or anywhere else in this case?
No, Your Honor. But I would point out that this is Officer or Agent Ray's testimony on the stand at the time is that he believes that Ray refers to drugs based on his investigation. On the stand, he believed it referred to drugs, not necessarily at the time he heard it.
I know, but how can an agent? That's like an agent gets on the stand, the lead agent, and says, "Ladies and gentlemen, I know in the surveillance you see an Uber Eats coming up, but I'll tell you that's actually a drug deal happening." How is that different?
Well, Your Honor,
he just says the word Ray is the drugs they found, and that ties it, that nails them for constructive possession.
Your Honor, he says that the word Ray, based on the investigation, based on finding...
Tell me what it was elsewhere in the investigation. What possibly connects the word Ray to drugs?
The fact that they found Ray, found drugs in a cabinet, which he was referring to.
Okay, so that's the only other thing. Usually in these cases, you maybe were sitting in here before, usually what happens is the agent says, I've listened to all the wiretaps, and this is the code word, Ray, and I've heard it a million times, and they correspond. This is sort of the unusual case where an agent's just decided he's got a really incriminating call. He'll pick out a word, Ray, and he'll tell the jury, that's the drugs we found. And what's the personal investigation that corroborates it? We found the drugs. Is that the logic?
I don't believe that is the logic, Your Honor. I believe the logic that he's saying is that after doing the investigation and listening to that call, he believes that it was not a person being referred to. It was the drugs. Because they found drugs in the cabinet, they did not find a person in the cabinet. And that the call also starts with talking about Vic, a different person. So I think those three things together can lead an officer to believe, hey, that's a code word based on this investigation. I know that oftentimes we see this as a wiretap significant surveillance over time.
Almost always. What's your case? What's your best case that the agent can just find one phone call and say that one word doesn't mean a human being? It means this particular drug that we found and charged.
Your Honor, I think that... So I think we all agree that this falls potentially...
I'm asking for your best case just on that proposition. There's never been used of the word anywhere else in the investigation. Wiretap anywhere.
Yes, Your Honor.
That's the logic of the government agent that's going to look at the jury and say, actually, that ties it to Wilson.
I think it's Elmazon.
Okay.
And Ebron. And okay.
All right. Well, tell us Elmazon. What was the connective tissue in Elmazon?
Your Honor, Elmazon was... I would point to the... I can't remember the name, but the Hamas terrorist cell in Philadelphia, where one of them said that the brother uses a code name, right? And that's based on his investigation. But Elmazon, as you noted, specifically points out it doesn't require just the one listening, just that one aspect of an investigation. It can be the entire investigation. And Agent Brand's engaged in this entire investigation. So I think you have to look at it in the sense of, he's not just saying Ray means Ray because I think it's drugs. He's saying Ray means Ray because based on my investigation, I found drugs where they said they would be. I've seen them be engaged in drug dealing activities. And at the end of the day, there's nothing that requires any more than that. And this is a clear error standard. I mean, they didn't object to the use.
Well, that may be your best argument. I'm just not understanding how the government's moving Category 3 into Category 1. Elmazain is a massive, many years investigation into terrorist brothers. So you would think an agent then could be cross-examined and direct examination about how he knows the relationship. Here, as far as I can see, but correct me if wrong, you got one super incriminating phone call that is the phone call that ties a defendant to narcotics. And the agent just tells the jury, even though it doesn't say anything about him or the drugs, I'll tell you.
When a party fails to object at trial, an appellate court reviews alleged errors only for plain error. Under that standard, the defendant must show that there was an error, that it was plain or obvious, that it affected substantial rights, meaning it likely influenced the verdict, and that it seriously affects the fairness, integrity, or public reputation of judicial proceedings. It is a high bar, designed to respect the trial record and prevent sandbagging. But appellate courts will reverse under plain error when a clear legal mistake probably changed the outcome or undermined confidence in the trial's fairness.
It is about that drug in that cabinet, in that bag.
Your Honor, the second Haynes category does not say extensive investigation. It says based on the investigation of the officer. And that's what we have here.
But isn't it circular to say the only investigation that confirms it is we found it? Do you have a case that allows that?
I don't offhand, Your Honor. I don't think it's circular, though. I think
wouldn't that allow in any drug case, any word ever used, to allow a lead agent to look at the jury and say, I'll tell you, that's what they were talking about.
Not any word ever used, Your Honor. I think Haynes, specifically the third category.
It's got to be an unusual word.
would have to be something that's not a commonly used word, like stuff, it, that. But I don't think it's, I think the fact that they find the drugs, I mean, that goes to a credibility of his opinion, right? If he says, I think it's Ray because they deal drugs, Ray is drugs because they deal drugs, that might be rejected. The same way that officer or agent Bren says, that's the backpack that we found in the house, and the jury rejects that by saying, well, we're not finding Enclave guilty of possession of the drugs in that backpack.
Well, our court and every court has warned the government about lead agents because juries are very impressionable. And that's why you have confrontation clause problems. That's why you have 704B problems. You can't just say, I know he was thinking like a drug dealer thinks. And then we get into the world of lay versus expert. He wasn't qualified as an expert, so he's a lay witness. It's got to be on personal knowledge. No one ever used Ray before. But he's going to say Ray is drugs. That's powerful. No objection.
There's no objection. It's crossed extensively.
How else do you tie Wilson to the drugs?
You know, Wilson?
Besides the jailhouse call and the word Ray.
Well, Wilson, Your Honor, is the stash house is the things in the stash house significantly tie Wilson to the drugs, Your Honor. He has mail from his bank in there. He has his car registration in there.
Well, you know they both have access. The question is, how do you tie it? Were the drugs in plain view?
Your Honor, they were in plain view. There was drugs throughout the house.
They were in a cabinet under the sink.
Well, some of the drugs were in a cabinet under the sink. Others were out in plain view. There is the manufacturing, the hydraulic press. You have the baggies, the vacuum seal, the scale with drugs on it. And that's all in plain view in the house. I mean, you have the guns in plain view. This is not a case of the only evidence tying these two men together in the conspiracy is the meaning of the word Ray. And I would point out that even if you took the Ray testimony out, let's say that Agent Brenz doesn't testify to the meaning of Ray, but said there's something under the thing, under the cabinet, and then later says, oh, by the way, under a cabinet, we found a bunch of drugs. We did not find anything else. And the jury can say, okay, we're going to connect that. So for the sufficiency argument of that, I don't think there's any issue there.
Did the government rely and amplify in closing the Ray comment, or did it just say, we found the drugs?
It was included in the closing, but it was in the context of all of the evidence against them. I think the government mainly relies on the evidence found in the stash house and the poll camera videos showing what – hand-to-hand and them being around the stash house for long periods of time. So I think that in terms of whether or not this on clear error is a reversible, even if this court finds that, hey, we shouldn't have been able to define Ray, I don't believe that warrants a reversal. I think that this is not an error that rises to that level because of all of the other evidence involved. And all of the other decisions that the jury was permitted to make and did make based on the evidence. Your Honors, I'd note that there is some contention by both defendants that in sufficiency that they were only there three times. I would note that was just the three poll camera clips that were played to the jury. Agent Brenz did testify that his observations were throughout the day, throughout every day, for weeks at a time, that they were at the stash house engaging in what he believes to be drug.
Who was convicted on count two? Was that just Enclave?
Sorry, Your Honor, count two is I believe just Wilson. Is that the possession of the drugs in the house?
Isn't that Wilson?
Yeah.
Okay, that one charges fentanyl. Where was fentanyl found?
Fentanyl, they found 100 grams of fentanyl in the house, I believe, in the living room or the kitchen.
In plain view?
Yes, Your Honor.
Because that's not in the backpack.
No, Your Honor, no. The backpack, and I think, and perhaps this wasn't clear from my brief, and I apologize, that the backpack did not contain all of the drugs found. It contains some of the drugs found in the house.
The meth and the heroin.
Right.
The fentanyl's elsewhere, but it's in plain view.
Right. And again, they found residue of the drugs elsewhere as well in the house, on the scale, specifically on the kilo press, things of that nature.
And did Bress say the backpack had characteristics that allowed him to say it's a particular defendant's backpack or not?
So, Your Honor, he said that the backpack – Well, he said that Enclave was carrying a backpack in one of the poll camera footages because the strap was hanging down. He said that the strap indicates that that's a two-handled backpack being worn over one arm or one shoulder, and then they found a backpack that he believed to be the same backpack under the sink. That would connect Enclave to the drugs in the house, which he was acquitted of.
Okay, so if an agent testifies their personal characteristics to what I'm seeing in this photo that I tell you, jury, is consistent with characteristics in the bag, that seems strong permissible to me.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor.
And, the gun, although we're a little unsure about which gun tied to which photo, I don't think he made those, this gun's got these characteristics. That'll be helpful to you, jury, as you assess if it's one and the same.
And Your Honor, I don't know. I think the gun photos, the ones that they found in the stash house, they had photos of those from the stash house, the encampment address. The photo of Enclave engaged in the hand-to-hand, Wilson engaged in the hand-to-hand drug sales with a gun in his hand, I don't think that they were able to particularly identify what gun that was.
The last related thing I was hoping you could address is the rebuttal argument.
Yes, Your Honor.
Are you acknowledging it was error, but it was invited error? Is that what you're saying?
Your Honor, the government doesn't acknowledge that all of the statements were error or any of the statements were error. We think that
I thought you defended this on the invited error doctrine.
We're not conceding that there's error, but we're saying even if there
did you make any argument that it wasn't, or did you just defend it on invited
error? We argued that there was some proper comments based on
not some proper. We know what the one you're talking about. What prosecutor can ever say law enforcement knew these people?
You're right, Your Honor. So those type things, that conversation, which also dealt with the warrant, I believe, that is what we classified as more of a gray zone, but we defend that comment.
Let me just be specific, because I'm not going to let you get away with more of a gray zone. Is that error or is that not for a government prosecutor in rebuttal argument to tell the jury, we didn't do something because law enforcement knew they were the ones?
Your Honor, if it is error, it's not prejudicial.
Okay, and it's not prejudicial because it was invited?
In part, sure.
Okay, now tell me the fight fire with fire argument, invited error, assumes an original error. What was defense counsel's erroneous argument that allowed the government to miss step two?
Your Honor, I think that the attack on the warrant is really what
but there's nothing erroneous. They're saying you didn't have forensics. Now that may be a silly argument for a gun, but there's no error and the government didn't object.
Right.
So how are you arguing on appeal the invited error doctrine has anything to do with anything if there was no original error?
Your Honor, we believe that there was an original error that we applied, but that's not the only.
Okay, let's stop there again. If there was original error, did you object and say to the district court that there's error?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. So now just tell me exactly what the defense did wrong that allowed the government to transgress too. Just be as clear as possible if you have a case. What did the defense do wrong in their closing that permitted the government to take its own wrong step?
Your Honor, other than what I've already mentioned, I don't have any.
But have you mentioned anything?
Your Honor,
what did they do wrong?
Can you answer that,
Your Honor? What we believe that did wrong was improperly attack the warrant and the investigation. Whether that is this court's opinion or not, I can't say.
Okay, and I'm just asking you, what's improper about attacking a warrant?
Your Honor, I don't think I have a good answer for you at this time.
So really, the answer is it's an isolated comment. And the jury was told, don't really listen to the attorneys.
Right, Your Honor. Like, the magnitude of it is small in the grand scheme of things. The instructions are there to negate it. The evidence is strong against the two defendants. I mean, even if this it's in the rebuttal closing, I mean, as this court knows, there were several closings because each side got some. And I think just the isolated error would not warrant the high burden it is to overturn a conviction based on closing comments. Pending this court's.
Anything else that you would like to say that you haven't said?
No, Your Honor, I think that those three issues are the three issues that the government would hope to address. So I would just rest on my brief on the rest of the issues. Thank you.
Briefly, Your Honors, I want to highlight the fact that my client, Mr. Inclay, was in fact acquitted of the charge of possession with intent, count two. Mr. Wilson was convicted on that charge. But I think that point highlights the extenuated nature of the evidence that tied Mr. Inclay to the damning evidence at this.
The jury was pretty alert. They're being very particularized.
They're right.
They see guilt, they don't.
That's right. That's and they didn't see it in terms of his connection to the contraband at the stash house. And so the question is, well, how did they come back and then inconsistently, in some respect, find him to have knowingly participated in an agreement with Wilson to violate the narcotics laws? And I think it really boils down to this agent's statement that Ray means what it means. And I think Your Honor has the correct read on it. It has admissibility issues with it, but if you listen to even the context of the phone call, it's a strained interpretation of what is actually said.
You weren't trial counsel, were you?
Sorry?
You weren't trial counsel.
I was not trial counsel.
I mean, obviously, when a lead agent testifies to opinion that just has no connection, you expect an objection. And then all this gets hashed out, right?
That's right. I agree with you.
Or you could cross and say, what a ludicrous statement to say, Ray, and you sort of laugh in front of the jury. The government's putting an agent on to just say something impossible.
And you know, in fairness to trial counsel, I think they did that in their closing, and I think they drew attention to it. But, you know, the jury
if
itself.
If you start going that direction, then it sounds like the jury heard it. It seems pretty harmless.
But the jury is charged with not rubber stamping even expert testimony. They have a duty to scrutinize.
Can you put up the gun photo issue? Because I probably mixed that up.
That's co-counsel's client.
So Wilson was the person in the photo.
With the gun.
With a gun.
Yes.
And did that gun end up getting charged?
I'm not positive at that point. But I do think it was an important point, and I think it really colored the whole argument that these guys were engaged in a conspiracy. So I do think it was prejudicial even to my client. And I would invite you also to look at 785 of the record. That is when Brenz was cross-examined about the nature of the surveillance and the connection between Inclay and Embankment Street, Encampment Street. And he basically concedes that it was, you know, that there was three visits within 3 weeks. I see I'm out of time. Thank you, Your Honors.
Very quickly, Your Honor, the gun that was in the surveillance videos, that was found at the Holly Grove address, and it wasn't charged.
It wasn't charged.
Exactly, but it was certainly...
That's why that's much less relevant.
Yes, though certainly prejudicial because it's showing him possessing firearms and then he's later convicted of possessing firearms in his home. The government said, I want to really make sure that this comes out. The government said that this was permissible because it was based on his investigation as a whole. So his opining that these are drug transactions, him opining that Ray refers to narcotics, he can do that because that's his investigation as a whole. They have lost it right there. It is clear and obvious law that lay opinion testimonies by law enforcement agents cannot be based on their investigation as a whole. And this is Haynes quoting Grenage, which was incorporated in. It is improper to base knowledge on the entire investigation because his knowledge of the defendant's activities. And the reason for that is that goes beyond personal knowledge of the investigation and ventures into speculation, right? So you can't just say, I know these are drug transactions because our investigation as a whole showed that they were drug dealers, which is what he did repeatedly over and over again.
Did you get a chance to look at footnote 13?
I did.
What doesn't it say the opposite of what you're saying?
So in Elma Zane, there was a call where it's talking about someone being sick. And what the agent did was provided the jury with firsthand information that they do not have, highly specific. So he doesn't say the investigation as a whole tells me who he's talking about. He says, the someone being referenced in that call, here's what I know that you don't, jury. There was an assassination attempt. And so we know that the person being referenced in that call was the person referred to as being sick. That is very, very different from taking surveillance videos, claiming something is a hand-to-hand drug transaction, and saying that's based on my investigation.
Right, but on the more sort of inflammatory Ray point, since there was no objection and this wasn't fleshed out below, their argument is it was tied exactly to him going in the house, finding the drugs, exactly where the phone calls said they would be.
Right, two things. So that's, I think, as you referenced when you were talking to the government, that's entirely circular, right? It's saying we know that they're talking about drugs because these are drug dealers. We found drugs, right? But the second point on that is that in Al-Mazain, that information was not available to the jury. Haynes is very clear. You cannot make an inference for the jury that they could make on their own. And I also want to point out, based on the record, the inference doesn't make any sense because the government claimed below and Agent Bruns claimed below and are claiming now that he was referring to the black backpack under the sink. The Ray phone call happened on September 30th. The video of him taking the backpack in the house isn't until October 4th. So it doesn't even make sense. And I think that that's what's really important, right? That shows that this is entirely speculative. And that's why it's so important that we enforce the rule that you can't just usurp the issues before the jury. The jury was required to make that determination. And it was incredibly prejudicial to do that, to say, well, don't worry, I know, I'm the agent in this case. My investigation as a whole jury shows that. And I also just want to alert the court that under a plain error, and I've lost time, but that it's not a sufficiency inquiry under part three of plain error. So we don't do sufficiency anew. We don't take out the impermissible evidence and then say whether it was sufficient. We say, is there a reasonable probability that this jury would have come to a different result? And Judge Higginson, as you highlighted, this was a very alert jury. And this was a case built on inferences. So if we take away the inferences that were made for them, there certainly is a reasonable probability that they would have come to a different result. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
The outcome of this appeal will turn on whether the Fifth Circuit finds the evidence legally sufficient to support the conspiracy conviction, whether the lead agent's interpretive testimony crossed the line from permissible lay opinion into impermissible expert conclusion, and whether any errors in jury instructions or closing argument warrant reversal. No prediction should be drawn from the questions asked at oral argument. The court will issue a written opinion in due course, likely within several months of the argument date.